Okay. Should we start? Or you want to wait a few minutes?
Let's see. My watch says it's
9:02.
Yeah, I think maybe we should wait like a minute and a half to two. I would think.
Okay.
I'd say usually people.
I'm Rusty Eisenberg. I am legislative co-coordinator for United for Peace and Justice, and co-founder of Brooklyn for Peace, and sometimes professor of foreign policy. So I want to welcome everybody. There are a lot of people on the call, so we're not going to have time for people to introduce themselves, and we actually have put it on mute to avoid the echo, but I hope everybody understands. Tonight's national conference call is unique in that it is, I think, the first time that PDA, UFPJ, and Code Pink are co-sponsoring this together. And the topic for tonight is U.S.-Saudi alliance, and also something that seems like it was going to go on forever, maybe appears like it's going on forever, and what we as peace activists might do to address the cluster of issues around that alliance. Our presenter will be Medea Benjamin, who really needs no introduction, but I would just say co-founder of Code Pink, activist for many, many years, an inspiration, I think, to all of us. Medea is now finishing a book on Saudi Arabia and is helping to organize a Saudi summit in Washington, D.C. on March 6th and 7th. I hope I got those dates right, and she'll talk more about
six.
That. It's a 6th. And she'll talk a little bit more about that, you know, as something that people may want to attend to. So what we've done is we are muting everybody for now, and again, I hope everybody understands that. Medea is going to speak for 20, 25 minutes, and then we will open it for Q&A, and for people who want to ask questions, you know, you'll be able to do that. We have a technology in place to facilitate that. So, again, I just want to welcome everybody to the call. And, Medea, why don't you just start out?
Great. Well, thank you so much, Rusty, and thanks to PDA and UFPJ and those of you who are on from Code Pink as well. As Rusty said, I'm just finishing up a book on Saudi Arabia that's kind of a primer on understanding internally what's happening in Saudi Arabia and Saudi Arabia foreign policy and U.S.-Saudi relations. And so it's been a fascinating time for me to learn more about Saudi Arabia, and I'm excited to share it with you. I'm going to start out just by saying that as Americans, our job is really to critique our own government first and foremost. We are responsible for our own government's policies, whether it's our policies that have created chaos in the Middle East through the invasions of Iraq, invasions of Libya, supporting for Arab dictatorships for decades, or for the Israeli occupation, our military-industrial complex that fuels all of these wars. But I do want to critique Saudi Arabia itself, understanding that the U.S. relationship with Saudi Arabia has really helped to prop up this very repressive dynasty since the beginnings of the Saudi state in 1932, having survived 12 U.S. presidents, both Democratic and Republican. So we have a lot of responsibility in the continuation of this Saudi state. So let me talk about Saudi Arabia itself first. It's a very extremist government from the beginning, being founded by an alliance between the Saud family, Saudi Arabia is named after one family, and the Wahhabis, the extremely intolerant conservative branch of Sunni Islam. And this toxic pact between the Saud family and the Wahhabis has led to a country where there is no freedom of speech, no freedom of assembly, no freedom of association, no freedom of religion. In fact, you cannot have a church or a temple in Saudi Arabia. Shia in Saudi Arabia are extremely repressed. There is no fair judicial system. People have been imprisoned, sentenced to 1,000 lashes simply for blogging. Human rights attorneys are in prison for 10 or 15 years simply for trying to represent peaceful dissidents. Nonviolent offenders have been beheaded or even crucified. It's ironic to hear Donald Trump saying that he's so shocked at what ISIS is doing of cutting off heads, and he says, it's unbelievable. Look, we haven't seen this since medieval times. Obviously, he hasn't been looking at our ally Saudi Arabia that executed 157 people last year, mostly by beheadings and often in public squares. And just in the second day of the new year, January 2nd, 2016, they executed 47 people, most of them by beheadings, including the prominent nonviolent Shia Sheikh Nimr al-Nimr, knowing that this would touch off a crisis between Saudi Arabia and Iran. Women in Saudi Arabia live under a guardianship system where men totally control their lives, from whether they can enroll in school, if they can travel, who to marry. And Saudi Arabia is the only country in the world where women are not even allowed to drive. There are no political parties allowed in Saudi Arabia, no national elections. Under pressure from much of the world, Saudi Arabia decided there would be municipal elections starting in, there's been one in 2005, the second in 2011, and the third in 2015. In those first two elections, half of the municipal council people were appointed by the king, one half were elected. In the third that took place in 2005, one-third of them were appointed. 2005 was the first time women were allowed to vote in these municipal elections, but what is most important to understand is that these municipal councils have no legislative power at all. They focus on very local issues like trash collection and street maintenance. They have no power. The migrant population, which numbers about 6 million, is extremely exploited in Saudi Arabia under a sponsorship system where they are beholden to their sponsors. They're not allowed to change jobs without their sponsors. They're not allowed to even exit the country without their sponsors okay, making them really indentured servants. As far as the policy, foreign policy of Saudi Arabia, it is the Arab country most responsible for the spread of extremism. Going back to the 1970s, when they started putting billions of petrodollars into the building of madrasas or religious schools all over the Muslim world, building mosques, paying clerics to preach the Wahhabi type of Islam, bringing many students from around the world on scholarships to the kingdom to learn the Wahhabist point of view and go home and preach that. And we see the relationship between the United States and Saudi Arabia early on in terms of the funding of the Mujahideen in Afghanistan, which led to the creation of Al-Qaeda. You see the Saudis, if not the government, then individual Saudi citizens funding extremist groups like al-Nusra in Syria and the Islamic State as well. The number two group of foreign fighters fighting with the Islamic State, number one is Tunisia, the second largest group are Saudi citizens. The Saudis crushed the democratic uprising in Bahrain after the Arab Spring. They supported the overthrow of the democratically elected Muslim Brotherhood leader in Egypt, Morsi, and have now been supporting the coup leader, Sisi, to the tune of many billions of dollars. And they, since March of last year, have been waging a very horrific war in Yemen, where many thousands have died, and it's led to a tremendous humanitarian crisis. The U.S. role in selling the weapons that Saudi Arabia is using in Yemen and directly coordinating the air operations has made the United States complicit in war crimes. The Saudis are also using cluster bombs in Yemen, some of which are provided by the United States. Getting into U.S.-Saudi relations, the pact from early on was that the kingdom would supply the U.S. with oil, and the U.S. would provide the kingdom with security and military assistance. Going back to the years of the Soviet Union, the Saudis were allies in the fight against communism, and the U.S. and the Saudis have a common adversary, and that is Iran. Today's relationship continues to have an element of oil, although the United States only is getting about 10% of its oil these days from the Saudi Arabia. A lot of the relationship is based on the sale of weapons to the kingdom. A White House press release in 2014 said that Saudi Arabia is the largest U.S. military sales customer, with active and open cases valued at approximately $97 billion. $97 billion. It's an incredible amount of sales. These include everything from the latest technology, F-15 bombers, Apache and Black Hawk helicopters, missile defense systems, bombs, armored vehicles. It's not only the sales, but the servicing of these weapons and the training. The weapons manufacturers that have been selling the most to Saudi Arabia are Raytheon, Lockheed Martin, General Dynamics, and McDonnell Douglas. The selling, they have been pushing these sales to offset military spending cuts in the United States and Europe. Another side effect of these weapon sales to Saudi Arabia is that it has spurred an arms race throughout the region, with other Gulf states competing. Israel always wants to outdo the Saudis and forces the U.S. to sell them one level up technology that they are giving to the Saudis or selling to the Saudis. Iran seeks countervailing weapons, so it fuels the arms race throughout the region. Other thing that many people don't recognize is that the U.S. taxpayer is paying for the huge U.S. presence in the Gulf that has become a subsidy for the big oil companies to protect the flow of oil in the Persian Gulf. By some estimates, between the 1970s and 2000, the U.S. spent over $8 trillion with U.S. presence from military bases in the region, aircraft carrier, weapon systems, personnel. There are about 35,000 military personnel in the region, 40 naval ships, aircraft carriers. So while the Saudis are buying billions in weapons from the United States, U.S. taxpayers are footing the bill for this massive military presence to shore up the Saudi regime. The other thing I wanted to talk about is the Saudi lobby. It's nowhere near as powerful as the pro-Israel lobby AIPAC, but it is a huge lobby. And in fact, this lobby grew tremendously after the 9/11 attacks, when the Saudis had such a bad reputation in the United States, they started hiring all kinds of firms to improve their reputation. The lobby group Corvus, which has recently been whitewashing the Saudis' bombing campaign in Yemen. Law firm Squire Patton Boggs is registered as a foreign agent for the Saudis. The largest PR firm in the world, Edelman, has been hired by the Saudis. They retain the law firm PLA Piper, Pillsbury Winthrop Shaw. The firms that include former senators like Saxby Chambliss, George Mitchell, and actually one former Republican, Norm Coleman, is a registered agent for the Saudi government. That's the same Norm Coleman who in 2005 signed a congressional letter condemning the Saudis for preaching Nazi-like hatred of Jews and spreading extremist ideology throughout the world. That was before he started getting paid by the Saudis. The Saudis have also contracted one of Jeb Bush's top fundraisers, Ignacio Sanchez, as well as the Podesta Group, which is founded by Hillary Clinton's, one of her top fundraisers and supporters, Tony Podesta. The Saudis also financed lots of D.C. think tanks, universities, nonprofits. The Clinton Foundation gets many millions from the Saudis, the Atlantic Council, the Middle East Policy Council, Middle East Institute, even the wonderful Carter Center that has a major program about empowering women and girls has taken Saudi money. And part of what this does is really bring silence. It buys silence about Saudi abuses or praise for Saudi reforms like the municipal council elections that I talked about earlier. So where do we go from here? I would say, one, that this is a very good time to be challenging the Saudis because it is a time of crisis in Saudi Arabia. With the falling oil prices has led to rising deficits and unemployment. The Saudis have been forced to cut into their massive welfare state, cutting everything from subsidies to fuel, electricity, and water. This means that people are starting to question more of the Saudi state, but let's not kid ourselves. They have a firm grip on power given the total control that they have. But it is a time where some are questioning the U.S. relationship to Saudi Arabia. We see Senator Chris Murphy, who has recently been asking why the U.S. is supporting the Saudis in their terrible bombing campaign in Yemen. And this is an opening we have to get other members of Congress to join with Chris Murphy on this, get a letter going to President Obama about this. I think we could try to insert this issue in the presidential debate, just some samples of questions we could ask the candidates. Why do you support the sale of weapons to Saudi Arabia, a country that chops the heads off of nonviolent dissidents and is engaged in war crimes in Yemen? We could ask some of these very pious Republicans if they think what they think about the Saudi U.S. alliance with Saudi Arabia, a country that does not allow non-Muslims to even build a place of worship or pray in public. Ask Hillary Clinton, what does she think of an alliance with Saudi Arabia where women need a male guardian to enroll in school, travel, marry, etc., and the only country in the world where women can't drive? And finally, I wanted to say that, as Rusty mentioned, we are having the first ever progressive gathering of people in Washington, D.C., March 5th and 6th, called the Saudi Summit, to understand, question, and brainstorm about campaigns we can have around Saudi Arabia. March 5th and 6th in Washington, D.C., we have many brave Saudis, because I must say it takes a very brave Saudi to speak out. Some of the people who were scheduled to speak have been called in by the Saudi embassy and intimidated and forced to drop out. Students who are here on scholarships have been intimidated about their participation in the summit. The Saudis have even taken on a smear campaign against Code Pink. But despite that, we have Saudi women coming, journalists, human rights lawyers. We are very excited that we have the son of Sheikh Nimr al-Nimr, who was recently executed, is going to come to speak out. We have Ali al-Ahmed, the head of the Gulf Institute, who has been speaking out for decades and is quite remarkable. We have representatives from the activist community in Bahrain and Yemen, and all kinds of other experts. Many of you know Chris Hedges, Vijay Prashad. So it'll be a packed full 2 days. And for those of you who are interested in coming, go on to the website, codepink.org. You'll find it right on the website, but it's if for any reason you don't, it's /2016 Saudi Summit. And for those who can't make it, it will be live streamed. So that's my basic presentation, and I think we were going to have Rusty start off the conversation. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. That was the most efficient use of 20 minutes I can remember. Thanks very much, Medea. Medea, I actually want to ask you to sort of backtrack just for a moment on one point that you made, which is about this Chris Murphy letter. And if you could explain to people what that is and how they can become involved in it, I think that that would be really helpful. And then I have one other question, and then we'll open it up.
Yes. So Chris Murphy has recently been speaking out about Saudi Arabia and said that it's time to cut off support. He said that he says that thousands of civilians have been killed, that conditions have deteriorated, and what he says is an already unstable country. I'm sorry, he's now talking. Just a second. He says that that there is no reason for the U.S. to be participating in this. I'm quoting him. I don't see any evidence right now that the Saudis are conducting their military campaign in a way that's responsible. It's feeding into the humanitarian crisis, and says Congress should block future sales to Saudi Arabia of weapons that would be used offensively in Yemen. So that is a great opening for us. We have been in touch with Chris Murphy's office and are pushing also in the House side. Chris is in the Senate. We met this last week with Hank Johnson, and he is very critical of Saudi Arabia, wants to do something about it. And there are a number of people, both in the Armed Services Committee and the Foreign Affairs Committee. I don't know if Gail Murphy is on the phone, somebody who's worked with Rusty a long time on the legislative side of United for Peace and Justice, but she's going to be working in the coming weeks to try to pull together people in the House and the Senate who are interested in questioning the arms sales to Saudi Arabia.
Well, that's great. Medea, I want to ask one last question, then I promise to turn it over to everybody else, which is I wonder if you would comment at all about the relationship between the nuclear agreement with Iran and how that might, affect things going forward in terms of the U.S. relationship to Saudi Arabia. If you have any sense of where that, does that create more openings? I mean, obviously it makes the Saudis very unhappy, but I wonder if you have any thoughts on that.
Yes, I mean, when I mentioned the execution of the very prominent Saudi sheikh, this was seen as the Saudis deliberately trying to provoke a crisis as part of their effort to recover their relationship, their close relationship with the United States, in a sense, forcing the United States to say what side is it going to take. The Saudis have been very critical of the nuclear agreement, although not as openly critical as Netanyahu in Israel, but critical nonetheless. And just like Israel has demanded more billions of dollars in U.S. taxpayers' money in exchange, in quotes, for this nuclear agreement, so the Saudis have been demanding more high-powered technology from the United States as part of their agreement with the United States to not make a fuss about the Iran agreement. But they certainly are not happy with it. And we see the Saudi-Iran adversarial position being played out in many places around the world, from Syria, where the Saudis are supporting the Sunnis and the Iranians are supporting Assad, his Alawite sect being a part of Shia, or whether it's in Yemen, where the Saudis are supporting the Sunnis against the Iranians, who are supporting the Houthis, who are a brand of Shia as well. So this sectarian divide between the Iran and Saudi Arabia is very dangerous, is causing tremendous suffering around the world. And the fact that the United States in the past has been so one-sided, supporting this extremist regime in Saudi Arabia, I think we're in a place where the nuclear agreement makes it possible for us to try to wean the United States away from this toxic alliance with Saudi Arabia and become not so much an ally of Iran, but at least not an adversary.
Thank you very much for that. Real quickly, I want to just let people on the call know that this is being recorded, or I believe it's being recorded, and people can go later tonight on the website for PDAAmerica.org, and it will to get the recording or to send a link for other folks. And I think as of tomorrow, it will be this will also be. There'll be a link on the United for Peace and Justice website as well. So please share that information widely. I think the way we have a technology that I'm not used to, but hopefully will work, which is if you want to have a question, unmute yourself now and indicate that you have a question. And Jackie Cabasso is going to take stack and will from United for Peace and Justice. And she will sort of recognize people. So for folks who have questions, please unmute yourself and make that known. Jackie?
Hello?
Hello?
Is it me, I guess? My name is Bruce. I'm in New York City. Thank you for this. Amazing discussion. I have, I guess it's a two-part thing. One is, what is the impact that you see of the collapsing of all the petrostates, and how does this affect the Saudis, who now have to evidently go to a system of taxation and cut some of the services that people have long known for free? It changes the relationship between this supersized family and everybody else who lives in the kingdom. And to take upon those examples that you gave of the revolving door in Washington, and the extent that the U.S. has used the Saudis as a cash register for funding a lot of very negative things, how much deeper is this relationship between the self-anointed U.S. elite and the Saudis? And to what extent should we be concerned about it? So I guess the first thing is, you know, their precarious situation as a petrostate.
Medea?
Okay, so precarious situation as a petrostate. I mean, the Saudis think that they have the cheapest oil, and that their gamble now is to keep putting out cheap oil on the market, to let the prices keep dropping, to push out all of those who have more expensive oil, whether it's fracking or the Canadian tar sands, or other countries that have, and most countries do, produce at their oil more expensively, that once it gets low enough to knock all these others out, then the price of oil will go back up and they will be back in the driver's seat. That is their gamble. We have no idea of knowing how it's going to play out, except we do know that in addition to all the other reasons I stated that we should be critical of the Saudi regime, they are also responsible for trying to keep the world on the oil treadmill. And I think there is an opening there for us to reach out to environmentalists. I know during the Paris talks, the Saudis played a terrible role. And the Saudis also feel that the world is going to move slowly but inexorably away from fossil fuels, and that they should be investing their money in diversifying. But it's very hard when your whole country, they have now 85% of their exports are oil, to move in a significant way in that direction. So they are feeling a pinch whether they can weather the storm and come back at the top with the prices coming up, or whether they could really diversify, which is unlikely because they've been saying that for decades now. We don't know. And in terms of the second issue of how deep are these ties, with all of these petrodollars that were flooding on the market in the 70s, 80s, 90s, a lot of that got invested in the United States and in Europe. And that got invested in everything from buying into U.S. companies, into stock market, into buying treasuries. And so there is a lot of intermingling of monies. And there is also a lot of investment. The Saudis until recently have had a lot of restrictions on foreign investment, although they're loosening it now with the need for an infusion of more cash. But there have been many companies that have been involved in very large contracts for construction, and for other infrastructure kind of building inside Saudi Arabia. So the ties between very large companies and the huge amount of money that's Saudi money that's in the United States, for example, the richest Saudi made his money from Citicorp stock. So, yes, extremely intermingled.
Thank you.
Thanks. Medea, on the death penalty issue, there are two rebuttals that I've read and heard, so I'd like you to say how you would answer both of these. Some people compare Saudi Arabia's executions to Iran's, are angry with Code Pink that we're not taking that issue on. People in Iran are stoned to death, which is a much more painful, slow death than beheading. And they also apparently have, by population, it's more executions by the size of the population. And then the other objection is that the U.S., numerous states in the U.S. execute people also. And in some cases, they die a very slow, painful death because the cocktail of drugs that's given to them doesn't kill them off quickly. So how would you speak to that issue?
Well, first let me say I think the Iranians are worse. They do execute a lot more people, over 1,000 people a year, compared with the Saudis. Last year was 158. So I'm not saying in any way that one is that the Saudis are worse in terms of numbers. The Chinese are terrible, too, in terms of their numbers of executions. But I don't think we want to compare them to the worst. We want to say that what they're doing is outside the bounds of human rights and international law. One of the things about Saudi Arabia, and what is worse, what you get you get evaporated by a U.S. drone, or you get your head cut off. You know, no matter how it happens, it's cruel punishment. And yes, whether it's a toxic brew in the United States prisons, I hope that people on the call are against the death penalty no matter where it is. The Saudis, one of the terrible things about them is that they often do these chopping of heads in public squares, and it's really meant to be a a threat to everybody else about this could happen to you. They also have something extremely horrendous, which is still done, not a lot, but it's done, and that is crucifixion. It's not in the old Christian sense of things. They first cut the head off, then they put the body up, and then they kind of sew the head onto the pole. But it's gruesome, and again, a way to terrify the population. And that the Saudis are killing people, for the most part, for nonviolent offenses. In fact, the majority of the killings tend to be for nonviolent drug offenses, and people say that they tend to be the smaller drug dealers, not the big ones. And you could also get the death sentence for homosexuality and for what they call sorcery. The death sentence, as I said, is terrible. Anywhere in Saudi Arabia, a Human Rights Watch says there's no excuse for the death penalty anywhere, but it's particularly appalling because in Saudi Arabia they're executing people for crimes like drug smuggling and sorcery that result in no loss of life. Meaning the people being killed have never killed anybody.
Thank you. When people come on with questions, it would be good to identify yourself. I'm thinking that was just Janet who asked that question from Code Pink, but others getting on with questions, please say who you are.
Hi, this is Steve Watrous in Milwaukee. Hello to Medea. I had a question. Well, too, really, I'm not sure I heard this right, but you mentioned quite a bit of U.S. arms sales to Saudi Arabia. That's pretty well known. I think you said some role in the whole thing. The part is, I wonder, isn't the pro-Israel lobby sort of some of these things that even with Saudi Arabia, aren't they a counterweight of some sort?
I didn't hear. Rusty, did you hear the question?
No, you're going in and out. So if you could.
Could you try it again, Steve?
Sure. The first was about the U.S. taxpayer role in sending any money to Saudi Arabia for whatever purpose of the U.S. government. And the other is the pro-Israel lobby is a counterweight of any sort to U.S. support for Saudi Arabia or connection with Saudi Arabia.
So right now there is a strange bedfellows between Israel and Saudi Arabia, and they're actually for the first time publicly had contact between them because they both have the same enemy, and that is Iran. So it's hard to see AIPAC these days as a counterweight around Saudi Arabia. And I'm not sure I got to, Rusty, maybe you did the first part of it?
No, I had a little trouble. I think, were you asking about the amount of arms sales that were I'm not actually sure what the first question was.
If I'm still on, you mentioned the arms sales. Everybody knows about that, but there was some talk about U.S. taxpayers doing something
right.
for Saudi Arabia.
Yes, that is more controversial because some people say the Saudis are actually repaying the United States and others say it's not true. But what I was referring to is the U.S. presence in the Gulf, not related to any wars going on, but the ongoing presence that the U.S. has had for decades in the Gulf with bases nearby and with warships. And all of that as a part of agreements with Saudi Arabia to provide for their security. So there are those that say that we have been spending billions of dollars to protect the oil companies and the Saudi government to be able to ship through the Persian Gulf. And so that's what I was referring to separate from the arms sales. The arms sales are you know, a big business for the U.S. Companies, and the other is the taxpayers paying for the U.S. military presence in the region.
Hi, this is Joanne Landy from the Campaign for Peace and Democracy. A couple comments. Hi. I think that the taxpayers are paying not only to help the Saudis and protect them, but also to support a long-term military presence in the region, which the U.S. wants for its own reasons. So that's kind of a twofer. I wanted to say a couple things about the Iran thing. I think that it's great that we have this conference about Saudi Arabia, and the Campaign for Peace and Democracy is supporting it, and it's brilliant, I think. I think it's also incumbent on us to find ways to protest the human rights violations in Iran, and that would get rid of that invidious question by people who really probably couldn't care less about Saudi Arabia, but are just bringing that up for opportunist reasons. I'm wondering, when you talked about the, Medea, when you talked about the candidates that we should be raising questions with, is there a way to get in touch with the Sanders campaign? Because the way he keeps saying that the solution to ISIS is to get the Saudis to go out there and fight them is a disastrous recipe. And I would think that we have people who are in contact with them, and there might be a good way to use this moment to change his thinking. And finally, one last thing. The Campaign for Peace and Democracy has a sign-on statement called End All U.S. Support for the Government of Saudi Arabia, and we'd really love it if all of you would sign on. I know both Rusty and Medea have signed, and you can go to our website at www.cpdweb.org, and it's also in The Nation this week on page 9.
Thank you, John.
Great. So just a couple of comments. Yes, I agree about Iran. We're hoping to have one of the leaders of the National Iranian American Council at the summit, and they are very critical of the Iranian government's human rights policies, but I think it's important for us as a movement to be explicitly against them, especially, as you said, as we do this Saudi work. So point well taken. I agree with you about Bernie Sanders. He says things like the Saudis need to get their hands dirty. I think we have to let him know that the Saudis' hands are plenty dirty.
Yeah.
And I have been sending things to a friend of mine working in the campaign. I'm sending them to other people. Several of them I know have been working in the campaign. We've been trying to get a sit-down with him and progressive folks like Phyllis Bennis to talk about foreign policy. I agree. I think it's been disastrous. On his website, his policy is quite good, actually. But when he speaks, he does not, one, speak with great authority, and two, does not say great things. So I agree with you. We have to keep finding ways to try to get to his campaign on this.
Thanks.
Hi, Stephen Costes of New York City. And I'm here to make a statement. I'm a strong supporter of the death penalty, and I oppose the institution of religion in all its forms. I really am disgusted beyond all capacity of forgiveness with the way the Saudi government is using it. Just wanted to let you, and I will not let you call me a bigot for being pro-capital punishment and anti-religion in all their respective forms.
Well, I certainly don't want to call you a bigot, and I'm glad you're on the phone, and I'm glad we have people who don't agree with each other on everything.
Okay.
Thank you.
You're welcome. Bye.
Sure.
Hi. This is Frank from North Carolina. Did you hear me?
Yes.
Okay, so this is what I want. You know, I look at the Saudis in Syria and them flooding the market with gas as trying to cause chaos in Russia, you know, because now in Russia, you know, they're running out of funds to keep their people quiet. So the more that they do that, the more that the Russians are going to have problems and are going to start thinking about coming to the table and maybe for some peace. And that's the way that I look at it at that situation. And Bernie Sanders, he said Muslim countries. He didn't just say Muslims. I mean, he didn't say Saudis. When you hear him the first few times that he has spoken, he said that Muslim countries need to step into Syria, not Americans, because you know all of that's going to do is cause more chaos. That's what he was saying. So I'm a Bernie Sanders supporter. And I think that's all I wanted to say. Thank you.
Sure. I think Bernie is fabulous on so many issues, from economic issues to climate to he's gotten so much better on the race issues. But I think on this issue, he has said Muslims, and he has also specifically said Saudis. But he talks about a military solution, whereas it's interesting, sometimes Donald Trump actually expressed it in a way that says what we've really got to do is stop the flow of oil, stop the money from going in, and stop the recruits from going in. And I think that's what we'd like to hear Bernie emphasize and not the military part of it. In fact, it was interesting when Joe Biden was speaking to a group of students at Harvard, he came out and he said, our biggest problem in the region is our allies, Saudi Arabia and Turkey and the Emirates and how they have been supporting the extremists inside Syria. And he was immediately berated for it and had to call up the Saudis and the Turkish government and apologize, but it's true. So it would be nice if Bernie would call out our, quote, allies as being a big part of the problem, unfortunately. And the other thing you said about the Saudi Arabia, one of its calculations being to hurt Russia, that's definitely true.
Medea, I'm going to just break in here for 1 second, take advantage of having the phone. I want to ask you a sort of expand that question. You know, we've been talking about Bernie Sanders and what he does or doesn't say, but I'm sure probably everybody on this call is, you know, variously horrified by the discussion of foreign policy that's going on with all the other candidates. And I'm wondering, I know Code Pink obviously is great at doing this, but in terms of people who haven't done it, as these primaries are happening and all these characters are going around, you know, most of them very belligerent in the way they're speaking, do you have any suggestions for people in terms of how to have a presence in these primaries and to be challenging the kind of discourse that's going on and raising these issues? Again, I know Code Pink does this almost, you know, automatically, but many activists around the country haven't really done it.
Well, we all have to do it and do it more, and we've got many months ahead, but let's not waste much time. I think that we should respond, for example, this last debate the Republicans had was just horrendous when they talked about five of them saying they would use waterboarding and torture. I think it would be good to go to their offices or wherever they're talking and do some symbolic waterboarding, which is very easy to do. I think if people don't want to do the symbolic waterboarding, at least get out there with signs saying torture is illegal, inhumane, quote, un-American, if you want to use that term. Unfortunately, it's all too American. And also they've been calling for Guantanamo to stay open and actually to send more people to Guantanamo for indefinite detention and waterboarding and other forms of torture. So I think we should get out on that issue as well. I think it would be great to really push the issue of do you support Saudi Arabia? And, you know, as these candidates are going around to meeting after meeting after meeting, it's actually easy to get in front of them and take it, put your phone on record, and just ask them, what do you think about our alliance with Saudi Arabia? Or you can ask them about what do they think about the support for Israeli occupation of Palestine, or, you know, whatever question that is most compelling to you, ask them about it. But I do think that this we haven't taken advantage of this moment in the most effective way we can, and let's do it in the coming months.
Thank you.
Okay, Rusty, this is Jackie, and yes, there are no more callers in the queue. Folks, somebody just popped on. Okay.
We have somebody on?
They disappeared. No, there's nobody in the queue right now. And I thought people would like to know that there were at least 123 people on this call.
Ooh, wow. Awesome.
Okay.
Every time you say there's nobody, we hear
a
little sound that says
question?
Next questioner.
Yeah, I know. I see that. Is there somebody with area code 704 wanting to speak?
Yes, me, Frank.
Okay, please.
Okay, here, let me just say what you're saying about Bernie Sanders. Bernie Sanders actually came on a show, it's called the Diane Reed Show, and he said that he supports a two-state solution. I actually asked him the question in a townhouse meeting, and the same question, and he more or less didn't want to answer it, but he more or less doesn't agree with Hillary Clinton that said that she said at the Brookings Institute that she supports what's going on over there. So, you know, people have a clear view of who they should be supporting on the Democratic side, I hope, if they're looking for a solution to the Palestinian, you know, what's going on with those people over there, and I'm supporting Bernie for that. That's all I wanted to say. Thank you. Bye. You hear me?
I think we did. Medea, yep. Did you want to comment, or should we wrap it up?
Why don't we take the next questioner? Yeah.
Okay, somebody just popped up. Area code 323.
Yes. Hi, this is Michael Kaufman from Oakland, California. You mentioned the Saudi war in Yemen. I'm interested in what role the United States plays in the Saudi war in Yemen and in Yemen in general.
So the United States has been responsible for providing the vast majority of weapons. But I do want to say, because I failed to say it earlier, that there are other major European countries that are supplying weapons to Saudi Arabia that are being used in Yemen. And those include the UK, Germany, Sweden. And in all three of those countries, there is a debate going on right now about whether they should continue to sell arms to Saudi Arabia, partly because of Yemen and also because of internal human rights abuses. And in fact, in Sweden, a very rigorous not only debate, but the foreign minister cut off arms sales to Saudi Arabia. The business community in Sweden had a fit about it. The Saudis recalled the Swedish ambassador, and the foreign minister was forced to back down. But it continues to be a heated issue. It really is only in the United States where we haven't managed to make this a major issue. In the UK, they also were able to cut off money for police training in Saudi Arabia. So U.S. is responsible for most of the weapons being used in Saudi Arabia and is also responsible for the logistical support. And when Chris Murphy questioned that, the answer from the administration is that we are helping them to be more precise in their bombing so they will kill less civilians. So it's thanks to us they kill fewer people. And he didn't buy that and said that that is absolutely unacceptable, that we shouldn't be involved in this at all. Let's remember that Saudi Arabia is interfering in the internal affairs of Yemen to begin with, and the U.S. should not be aiding them in any way. But I'm glad you brought this up because I think it's important for us to try to build a transnational coalition that focuses on this issue and that we learn from and work with our colleagues in the peace movements, in the progressive political parties. In Germany, for example, it's been the Green Party and the Left Party. And we really create an international coalition that opposes arms sales to Saudi Arabia, no matter what country they are coming from.
Thank you. If I may, I just want to jump in with one more question. What is the difference between Wahhabi and Salafi?
Well, it's questionable, and it depends who you ask. Some say that Wahhabi is similar to Salafi, except Wahhabi does not reconcile with modernism, whereas Salafist is trying to reconcile the purest Islam with modernism. Others say that people in Saudi Arabia, for example, don't like the term Wahhabism, and so they try to use the Salafism because they think it has a better connotation. And some will just say it really is the same thing and they can be interchangeable. So it depends who you ask.
Thank you, and thank you, PDA and UFPJ, for putting on this call, and thank you, Medea, for all the work that you've been doing for decades with Code Pink. Appreciate you all.
Well, that is a great wrap-up. I just want to, again, remind people that if you do want to get access to the recording of this call, the PDA website, we'll have it probably later tonight. UFPJ will have it on our website tomorrow. You'll have the link for that if you want to share this with other people. I also just want to emphasize that there's a lot of different interesting initiatives for us to take. And, you know, tonight we've obviously had the presidential contest on our mind, but speaking as somebody that works on the congressional side, in an election year, these folks are around. Also, they are in many cases quite accessible in ways they never are before. So these are also great opportunities to raise the issue of the U.S. alliance, Saudi Arabia, and other issues as well, is to really take advantage of these campaigns to gain access to the folks in Congress who, you know, otherwise don't necessarily get to meet all of us. So, I mean, there's a lot of work to do. I also want to remind people about the Saudi summit in March 5th and 6th. I think I got the dates right this time for folks who can get to Washington or to be able to watch it live streaming. And I also really want to thank Medea for doing a wonderful job, as always, and for the work that you're doing, which is really, really important, and making people think about things they might ordinarily not. And I want to thank PDA for co-sponsoring this, and Code Pink, and Jackie Cabasso. And good night to everybody, and thank you for joining the call.
Great job, Rusty. Thank you all. Good night.